Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities." Fellow Adamites, we're seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We're seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear, "Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you're already starting to see happen, then you'd best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and he shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation." Today is November 7th, 2010, Sunday, and Bill Fink is with us to discuss part one of Judaism in Germany, the coming triumph of Jewry over Germany, as it was written in the later decades of the 19th century. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh.
Well, this is Wilhelm Marr, right? In 1879, he wrote a pamphlet, a tract, describing what he saw or foresaw as the triumph of Judaism over Germanism in Germany. And today, in hindsight, that seems quite prophetic, doesn't it?
Yes, since it's an accomplished fact.
Well, right, it's absolutely an accomplished fact. It was an accomplished fact in... Well, the Jews thought it was an accomplished fact in 1918, didn't they?
Yes, sir.
And with the rise of Adolf Hitler, that precipitated another world war, and with the joining of America and Britain onto the side of the Jews, of course, Germany was ultimately defeated.
And you think we could rightly say, had it not been for Hitler and the National Socialists, Germany would have been 50% Turkish by the 60s.
Well, Germany would have been 50% Turkish by the 60s, and not only that, but the Cultural Revolution in America probably would have happened 30 years sooner. And we would have had Debbie Does Dallas in 1948, not 1968 or whenever it came out. I don't even know. Okay, I'd like to read a couple of lines from the preface of Wilhelm Marr's writings himself. I know we're not going to get into this until the next program. We're going to cover the Kevin MacDonald review of this work first, and I think that's important because Kevin has some excellent insight. But I would just like to read a couple of paragraphs here. This is from Wilhelm Marr's preface. "What I intend to accomplish in this pamphlet is less of a polemic against Judaism than it is a statement of facts regarding cultural history. Whenever circumstances cause me to use controversial speech..." And in other words, Wilhelm Marr in 1879 already had a sense of political correctness in Germany, right? I mean, this isn't anything new. The Jews influenced German culture and civilization in the 19th century, long before they influenced American culture and civilization the same way 80 years later. "Whenever circumstances cause me to use controversial speech, this can and must be understood as a quote-unquote scream of pain coming from the oppressed. Resigned pessimism flows from my pen. Just think, there will always be queer characters such as this one, but rest assured that nobody will be happier than I should the facts which I shall touch upon be shown to be untrue." In other words, he would like Germany to prevail, but he sees its forthcoming doom at the hand of the Jews. "Jews and Judaism have been attacked in literature innumerable times. This, however, has almost always been done from the point of view of our non-Jewish inflated opinion of ourselves, or, may I say, in the vainglorious style of retreats such as Gambetta's. Our conceit has not yet permitted us to admit that Israel," he makes the mistake of confusing the Jews with Israel, "has become a world power of the very first rank." He already recognizes Jewish commercial power and Jewish power in Western governments. "We have managed to understand the Jews, but we have failed to understand ourselves." He realizes that the triumph of Judaism over Germanism wasn't really because the Jews have a better system, have a superior intellect. Rather, it was because we don't understand ourselves. We don't understand our own nature. and the nature of our own people. It's our failure that they prevail over us.
Their success is primarily due to our lack of unity.
Well, that's a big factor in it. Yes, what we have a total lack of unity, and the only successful unity that the white race has ever had, which prevailed over the Jew, it is in Christianity, is in Christ. And when we reject that, the Jew wins, and that's why we're in the situation we're in today. Yeah, you want to go on with Kevin McDonald's interview? And let me make a couple of remarks first. I'd like to say that Wilhelm Marr is often very sympathetic of the Jew, as we've just seen in these opening remarks in the preface to his book. And he's really not the critic of the Jews themselves that he's made, the anti-Semite he's made out to be. But I think that anybody that simply tells the truth about the Jews is hated. That's the bottom line. And they'll brandish him an anti-Semite because Satan hates light. Satan hates to be revealed for what he is. So anytime anybody tries to pull the covers off the devil, he's going to be branded an anti-Semite. It's the same playbook over and over again. It's been going on for 7,000 years, never mind 200.
All right, take it from the top then.
Yes.
Kevin McDonald's article, Wilhelm Marr's The Victory of Judaism Over Germanism, Viewed from a Non-Religious Point of View, January 6, 2010. Wilhelm Marr, 1819 to 1904, has gone down in history as the first racial anti-Semite.
Now, I would think that anti-Semite is a misnomer there, but if we're going to talk about the first racial anti-Jew, well, we have to go back at least to the time of Jesus Christ.
Well, Jesus Christ and John the Baptist both called them a generation or a race, a genos of vipers. Didn't they use that term?
Well, they absolutely used that term. They were absolutely talking on racial terms.
And certainly Martin Luther, he came to understand them as a race, didn't he?
Yes. I just think that most people don't understand the Christian New Testament, and that's why Wilhelm Marr is given this distinction, right? So easily. Because even Kevin McDonald, he does very well on he's a psychologist, right? And he does very well on the from a psychologist's viewpoint on the evolutionary group strategy of Jewish survival, as he likes to call it. He does very well on that and exposing the Jews for the basic conspiracy that they are. And in the destruction of the West. However, he doesn't know anything. He's not an expert at religion, that's for sure, or Christianity. So we have to take him for what he is.
When they use the term racial anti-Semitism, they're making a distinction between the traditional Catholic religious anti-Semitism, that Judaism was a bad religion and Christians should strive to convert all the Jews.
Right. Right. The Catholic anti-Semitism was purely religious, if I have to call it anti-Semitism.
So sprinkle water on the head of Murray Cohen, and all of a sudden he's okay to marry your daughter.
Well, right, and that's the not all of the early Catholic bishops of Rome had that idea. Some of them actually forbade the conversion of Jews to Christianity. That did happen at times in the 5th and 6th centuries.
Mm-hmm.
However, a greater number of them had the lame-headed idea, the wrong idea, that we should convert the Jews to Christianity. And that's an arrogant viewpoint, because if Jesus Christ himself could not convert the Jew, what makes any man think that he could do better?
Certainly. They must think they have a greater ability than God.
Yahshua said that he didn't want us to convert them. There were people in Judea that he never wanted converted. That's very clear in the scripture. And we know them to be the Edomite Jews, those who claim to be Judah but are not, but are the synagogue of Satan.
All right. His signature work, The Victory of Judaism Over Germanism, Viewed from a Non-Religious Point of View, expressed Marr's views on the conflict between Germans and Jews in a strikingly modern manner. The pamphlet is difficult to obtain, and there have been no English translations. That's a shock. Now the text has been translated by Gerhard Roehringer, and I'm sure he's probably languishing in prison now, isn't he?
Well, I don't know where Gerhard is, but this booklet was only made available late last year, I believe, was the first time this was made available in the English language.
All right, and it is available online in PDF format. The following summarizes Marr's ideas as presented in this translation of the 8th edition, first published in 1879. Marr was a journalist, and his pamphlet is expressed in a journalistic style with all the pluses and minuses that entails. Marr's pamphlet contains a number of ideas that agree with modern theories and social science research on Jews, as well as some ideas that are less supported but interesting nonetheless. His ideas on future events are fascinating with the 2020 hindsight of 130 years of history. Marr describes his writing as a scream of pain coming from the oppressed, page 6. Marr sees Germans as having already lost the battle with Jewry. Judaism has triumphed on a worldwide historical basis. I shall bring the news of a lost battle and of the victory of the enemy. And all of that I shall do without offering excuses for the defeated army.
So Marr, Wilhelm Marr, was a watchman sounding the alarm, blowing the trumpet, and nobody listened in 1879. And he actually names the Germans as the oppressed, not the Jews. When he says a scream of pain coming from the oppressed, McDonald correctly says that Marr sees the Germans as having already lost the battle with Jewry, 1879. And Marr is naming the Germans as the oppressed, not the Jew.
And isn't it an old Polish proverb, the Jew hits you and cries out in pain?
Yes, it is. And it's funny, but it's true.
In other words, Marr is not blaming the Jews for their predominance in German society, but rather blaming the Germans for allowing this to happen.
Well, look at what we have in America today. We've allowed the Jews to dominate Christianity.
So who taught that?
When the Christians tell us, Christianity tells us that the Christians should have nothing to do with Jews.
Who's to be blamed for that?
Well, it's 19th century Germany all over again.
You mentioned Debbie Does Dallas. Who's to be blamed that was allowed to be filmed, produced, and that people actually paid for it? Who's to be blamed that there was a demand for that kind of filth?
Well, Jews produce about 95% of the pornography.
But we can't blame them for white people buying it.
No, we can't. And white people are the consumers of pornography. There's no doubt. It's not the Negroes that made Hollywood rich.
And if white people actually practiced Christianity, Jewish pornographers would starve to death unless they went out and got a job.
Jewish pornographers would starve to death. How about Jewish bankers? How about Jewish casino owners? They'd all starve to death. If white people practiced Christianity, we would have no sin in our society. The Jews would have to up and leave. They'd have to go to China.
Marr is not blaming the Jews for their predominance in German society, but rather blaming the Germans for allowing this to happen. He sees historical hatred against Jews as due to their occupational profile, the loathing Jews demonstrate for real work. A gratuitously negative and overly generalized reference to the Jewish occupational profile and to their codified hatred against all non-Jews. Page 8. Historical anti-Semitism often had a religious veneer, but it was actually motivated by the struggle of nations and their response to the very real Judaization of society, that is, to a battle for survival. I therefore unconditionally defend Jewry against any and all religious persecution. So he's basically saying that the Jews were anti-European because they wanted to preserve their own Jewish identity.
Well, fine, but why do they insist on destroying our identity in order to preserve their own?
Mm-hmm.
I think Marr doesn't understand the religious struggle, and of course neither does McDonald, and that's the biggest fault here. However, we could see that they illustrate how the Jews act and what they do And we, through our better religious understanding of who the Jews actually are, can come to grips and understand that.
Since we know they're evil.
Well, absolutely. There's no doubt they're evil. That they only feign that they are the people of the Bible in order to have an easier route to perpetrating their crimes against our society. Mar didn't see that, but Mar did see that they would be victorious and that they did intend to overcome Christianity and Christian society.
And they've done that. And weren't we told that our kingdom will be handed over to the beast?
Well, absolutely. It's a fulfillment of prophecy, and it's our own fault due to our own sin. There's no doubt.
Nothing. Mar claims that Jews have a justified hatred towards Europeans. Nothing is more natural than the hatred the Jews must have felt for those who enslaved them and abducted them from their homeland. Now, I'd just like to say as an aside, they've never really had a homeland, have they? They've always been vagabonds and wanderers by choice.
Well, the Edomites usurped the true homeland of the real tribe of Judah. And when they revolted and caused all sorts of trouble against the Romans did enslave a good portion of the Edomites. But there were very few Jewish slaves in the 6th century A.D.
Well, Jews wouldn't make much slaves anyway, would they?
At the decrees of Justinian, and before Justinian, from the time of Constantine and Constantinus II, the decrees of the Byzantine emperors that forbid Jews from holding Christian slaves and from loaning money at usury in Europe and other things that really oppressed the Jew.
That's why they invented Islam.
Well, right. The practice of Christianity is what oppresses the Jew. I'm not sure Mar understands that.
That when Christians don't allow Christian brethren to be enslaved, to be bought and sold like cattle or goyim by the Jew, when they don't allow the Jews to charge you 400% interest or any kind of interest, they don't let the Jews live off of pandering, the Jews scream that they've been oppressed because they can't go work in the field. That's the only occupation they can handle.
Exactly. And the Jew has traditionally refused to work in the field. He would rather monetize and securitize the labor of others. And all of his endeavors are circled around the securitizing of other people's labor and other people's goods. Meaning the manufacturers of stocks and bonds and insurance policies and things like that. Things that turn other people's property into securities. That's what the Jew does best.
Ultimately, they turn other people's property into their property.
Well, that's how they do it, right. Legal theft. Legalized stealing, basically.
Nothing is more natural than the hatred the Jews must have felt for those who enslaved them and abducted them from their homeland. And we just addressed that. And then he says, though, i.e. the Romans. And McDonald notes, Mar seems unaware that the Jewish diaspora predated the failed Jewish rebellions of the first and second centuries. Continuing on with Mar, nothing is more natural than that.
Well, I would think there that McDonald is claiming that the Israelite diaspora is Jewish, and it's not.
You mean the Babylonian and the Assyrian?
Yes. They're not Jewish at all. They were the real Israelites. That was the dispersion of the true Israelites. Where the Jewish diaspora of the first and second centuries, that was the dispersion of the Edomite enemies of God and of Christ, who had usurped Judea in the first and second centuries B.C., just like they've usurped the nations of Europe in the 19th and 20th centuries A.D.
Just like in John chapter 8, when they said that they were of Abraham, yet they had never been in bondage anywhere to any man. Well, that must mean they were of Esau.
Right. Well, McDonald, with his limited knowledge of history, I mean, he's a bright man, but he's a psychologist. His limited knowledge of ancient history and his practical ignorance of the Bible, he would attribute the dispersions of the real Israelites of the Babylonian and Assyrian periods, he would claim that they were Jews and they're not.
All right. Nothing is more natural than that this hatred had to grow during the course of oppression and persecution in the Occident over the span of almost 2,000 years. Nothing is more natural than that they responded using their inborn gifts of craftiness and cleverness by forming, as captives, a state within a state, a society within a society.
Well, that's what they've always been allowed to do, and they've gotten away with it. If you read the Old Testament laws, the stranger in your land is supposed to be forced to keep your law.
Mm-hmm.
But the Jews have always gotten away with keeping their own laws apart from the host nation. So they've never really been responsible, and they've never they've always revolted against the laws of the host nation. When they're caught, kidnapping white children, white Christian children, what do? They bribe and threaten their way out of it so that they get away with it. That happened time and time again in the Middle Ages.
If they couldn't count, expect a Muslim invasion soon.
Well, right. If they couldn't bribe their way out of it, they threatened their way out of it and pulled every political ploy possible to skirt the local laws, to skirt the municipal laws of the various cities in Europe. They've done it over and over again, and they do it here. They always count themselves above the law of the host nation, and they always use the pretense of living by their own biblical law, which is really the Talmudic law, which is really a non-law because they're not liable for anything that they do to the goyim, to non-Jews, under the Talmud. So they've always used that as a pretense to escape being prosecuted by the laws of the people of the host land.
Well, the Talmud declares that the ego of any Jew becomes divine, and that is their law, their own ego. Whatever they want to do, they can do, as long as it's to a goyim.
Well, that's the... Yeah, right. That's the practice. It's not the pretense, though. But it's definitely the practice.
They call themselves holy, though, and they say that they're the people of the book. Yeah, just not our book. They're the people of Satan's book. Jews used their abilities to obtain power in Germany and other Western societies. By the 19th century, the amazing toughness and endurance of the Semites had made them the leading power within Occidental society. As a result, and that particularly in Germany, Jewry has not been assimilated into Germanism, but Germanism has been absorbed into Judaism, page 11.
Isn't that what happened here? I mean, Christian America has basically become Judeo-Christian America, which is in essence 100% Jewish philosophically. The entire philosophy of Judeo-Christianity is Jewish. None of it's Christian.
You can't have Judeo-Christianity.
Christianity has been stripped from Judeo-Christianity to the point where John Hagee denies that Christ is the Messiah.
Well, Christianity is basically the antithesis of Judaism, isn't it? They're polar opposites.
Well, Christianity is the polar opposite of Judaism, exactly. You cannot have Judeo-Christianity. It's an oxymoron. However, this has been sold on the people. They've been fooled into it. They've been deceived, just like Eve was 7,000 years ago, and now they're all in bed with the devil.
And they think they're righteous. They're practicing evil and calling it Christianity.
There's no doubt.
Marr claims that Judaism retreated in the face of Christian fanaticism and achieved its greatest successes first among the Slavs and then among the Germans, both groups that were late in developing national cultures. He attributes the success of the Jews in Germany to the fact that the Germans did not have a sense of German nationality or German national pride, page 12. This is a point that I have also stressed, and this isn't me speaking, this is me reading Professor McDonald's notes here. McDonald speaking, he's not quoting Marr either. This is a point that I, Professor McDonald, have also stressed. Collectivist cultures such as medieval Christianity tend to be bad for Jews, because Jews are seen as an out-group by a strongly defined in-group.
Because when Christians practice Christianity, it's anathema to the Jew.
And he says that it's just because the Christians have a strong in-group sense of association based on religious grounds. But in Spain, for instance, Jews were told, convert, leave, or die. A lot of them converted and stayed, and they ended up wrecking Spain. It took them about another 100 or 200 years, but Spain's a mess. Today they're a
mess. Yes, it is. Yeah, yes, it is, because you can't bring the devil onto your side. It's not possible. He's just an infiltrator looking to destroy. And Christians have never understood that a Jew cannot be converted.
You know, I mean, if you hand me a glass of water and there's a fly in the water, I'm not going to say, oh, put more water in there to clean up the water. I want to get rid of the whole thing. It's tainted.
It's as ridiculous as taking the sheep's outfit and dressing the wolf up in it. You still have a wolf, right?
Absolutely. So you can't afford to give the Jews the ultimatum of convert or leave or die. It has to be the final two, leave or die.
Well, right. It just has to be leave or die. Exactly. That's the only...
Sorry, go on.
That's the only defense against Judaism.
And when they've been told leave or die, those countries have held out pretty well, although most of those countries wind up being targeted by invasion, by outsiders.
All the time. What's written in Scripture, that the flood, the attacks of the devil on a woman, the flood released from the serpent's mouth, we couldn't avoid it, but that doesn't mean that we can't withstand it. We have to withstand it.
Just because it's an arduous, difficult road, and we're probably going to lose because they'll bring the whole world down on us, it doesn't mean we should hand over our country without trying. Look what the Tsar did. They told him, accept the Rothschild Central Bank. He said no, so they had a Bolshevik revolution, and they killed his entire family. He probably could have saved his whole family by just having a Rothschild Central Bank, but that would have handed Russia over in probably 1880 to the Jews, and they would have been the most degenerate country in the world by 1920.
He still would have destroyed their family. In three generations, they'd have been marrying Negroes. So what's the difference? It's better to resist the devil.
Well, Christ said, fear not them which can only kill the body, but can't touch the soul. Rather, fear the one who can destroy the body and put the soul into hell.
So you never want to be a sellout.
But here in America, we basically just rolled over in the 60s and said to the Jews, here's our daughters, take them.
Well, right. That's exactly what we did. We made heroes of Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin and all those other Jew bastards. And they have all our daughters now.
And it was basically without a shot being fired, where at least the Germans, they went down fighting.
Yes, that's true.
Marr claims that Judaism retreated. Oh, wait, I already. Okay. Collectivist cultures such as medieval Christianity tend to be bad for Jews because Jews are seen as an outgroup by a strongly defined in-group. And then he cites an article. Moreover, a general trend in European society after the Enlightenment was to develop cultures with a strong sense of national identity where Christianity and/or ethnic origins formed a part. Although after the Enlightenment, they were basically pushing Christianity aside in many cases, weren't they?
Many cases they were trying to call Christianity. And you know, it's probably true of Catholicism. Catholicism had to be thrown off. The yoke had to be broken because the Catholic popes were, well, first, most of them weren't Christians. A lot of them were Jews, and they were destroying Europe in order to rule over it, to ensure their rule over it. And that's what the 30 Years' War and the surrounding events was all about. The Enlightenment was, in many cases, a revolt against Catholicism, but it was Christianity that was seen as the culprit. And people couldn't distinguish at that time between the two. And, well, the reformers knew that Christianity and Catholicism had nothing in common.
And I think part of the problem is they basically threw the Pope out of Catholicism or out of Christianity in countries such as Britain, but then they just adopted papalism in terms of doctrine, you know, Episcopalianism, Church of England. They kept a lot of papal doctrine and just threw the Pope and the bishops out.
The Reformation didn't go far enough. And that's exactly what happened in England, and that's exactly what happened with Calvinism.
Calvin became the Pope of the Reformed church, didn't he, in Switzerland?
Well, absolutely. They adopted their own style of more localized popery, yes.
So instead of having a pope in Rome, now you have a pope 5 miles away in Geneva.
Right. And that's why when this nation was formed, that's what the separation of church and state was all about. It wasn't the separation of religion and state or Christianity and state. It was the separation of any authoritarian ecclesiastical power over the government of the people. And the ability of people to make their own choice concerning religion. That's what that was all about.
I basically see it as that. In addition to the fact that we're not going to have a tax-supported state church, the government's not going to say, oh, we want to be Anglican, we want to be Methodist, we want to be Presbyterian, we want to be Catholic. There's not going to be some centralized, bureaucratic, hierarchical church that the government says you have to worship this way, you have to believe 2 sacraments, or no, you have to believe 6, you have to say this sort of prayer of the Mary, you have to do this. It's basically believe in Christ and be white and you're welcome in America.
Well, right, and a lot of fools think that the Founding Fathers were deists, and that's a lie, and I went far enough to prove that on the 10-10-10 series. The Founding Fathers weren't deists at all. Every one of them were Christians. They were anti-pope, and they were anti-rituals. They were anti-Anglican church, they were anti-Catholic church, and they were anti-sacramentalist, okay? They didn't. John Adams said he wouldn't have anything to do with that. I forget the exact word he called it, but to him it was a lot of BS, the ruling of over men's faith with sacraments, which is what today it's, you know, it's even in the Baptist churches that they're basically sacramentalist of a different sort. But when you start telling men you have to perform this ritual, you have to perform that ritual, if you don't, we're going to excommunicate you. You're not going to be saved. You become a sacramentalist.
You become
their
God.
The founding fathers were against sacramentalism because they couldn't find those sacraments in the Bible. Those sacraments don't exist in the Bible. Catholicism does not exist in the Bible, and neither does Anglicanism. The Anglicans didn't go far enough. They reinvented an English sort of popery.
Absolutely, and if somebody says that they have the ability to confer a sacrament upon you, they're basically becoming your God. There's no one can stand between your relationship to God, assuming that
you're... Well, absolutely. No man can interfere with your relationship with God. No man can baptize me and save me. I've been saved by Yahshua Christ. That's it. If you're a Christian, you've been saved by Jesus Christ. You don't need a priest.
Absolutely. And we were told to call no man father. We have one
absolutely.
Father in heaven. And the founding fathers knew that. All right. These cultures tended to exclude Jews, at least implicitly. An important aspect of Jewish intellectual and political activity in post-Enlightenment societies has been opposition to national cultures throughout Europe and other Western societies. Marx credits Jews with bringing economic benefits to Germany. Well, that's quite a stretch, isn't it?
Well, you know something? That's why Charlemagne brought the Jews into Europe, because he liked the economic benefits that they offered. That was the exact reason why he said he did it. They were good for economic benefits, because Jews were good at monetizing. Christians didn't even use money. They paid their taxes in kind, meaning that if you wanted a percentage of my, I'm a serf, and if you're the Lord and I'm your serf, what you get from me as a percentage, you get 25% of my cattle and 25% of my crops. Now, what you do with them is your business.
Sure.
So now what are you going to do with 25 cows and 3 tons of vegetables? You'd rather have 30 or 40 gold pieces, right? That's where the Jew came in. That's where the Jew was considered useful, because the Jew who hardly ever worked with his own hands, what was the great merchant. I mean, that's what they did. That's all they did. Christians didn't want to be concerned with merchandise. Christians wanted to work their land and be left the hell alone, or work their trade and be left the hell alone. Well, the Jew came in as the merchant and was able to monetize and securitize everything. They were the perfect middlemen.
The king likes the Jew because in taxing the peasantry or in allowing the Jew to loan onto usury, he generates an excess in money from what existed beforehand. We've been over this too, that there's only a certain amount of money in the town, and when two villagers borrow at usury, they now have to pay back with some of their property. The Jew liquidates, it creates an excess that can be taxed, and the king taxes the Jew while the Jew benefits off the people. So the king is basically, through the Jew, robbing his own people to support and sustain his lifestyle or his imperial adventures.
Well, that's why usury is evil, and that's what people don't understand about usury. It is how usury works. When you have 50 people in the town that all work hard and produce so much money in goods a year, and two or three people in that town have usurious loans with the local Jew, then they are actually allowing that Jew to suck up some of the goods and services produced in that town.
Yes.
So you know, we have like that Ross Perot giant sucking sound. What we have is we have a the beginnings of a flow of goods and services out of that town into the purse of the Jew through the few people that have loans out on usury. So you really, by you taking a bank loan out on usury, you're really stealing from the people in your community and bringing that to the Jew, because you're taking the money that you make in the community and you're not returning it to the community by purchasing the goods and services of others.
And historically, in some cases, villagers had to bail out others who were in over their head, and many people lost farms.
Well, that's the inevitable result of usury.
If there's a limited amount of money in the town and the Jew demands payment in full and you have nothing to pay him, you end up losing your land.
Well, usury is it is stealing. And it has been the primary way which the Jew has stolen all the property of Christendom.
The Jews have stolen the world through usury. They claim that they can create something, wealth, out of nothing.
Well, for 1,000 years, usury was barred from Christendom. And when the Catholic Church, under the Jewish de Medici popes, defined what usury was, that opened the floodgates for the Jews.
We don't need a Catholic definition when the Bible's pretty clear on the matter.
Well, right, but the Catholics changed that definition to too much interest. And that Catholic definition stands today.
It's unfortunate, though, many people in this society just can't make it without those loans. That's how dependent our society's become on usury.
Well, that's because people think they can't make it on those loans, because people want what they want now, and they're willing to take loans out on usury in order to get it, instead of waiting and saving their money for what they want, or instead of settling for something less. Yeah, you know, you might be able to afford a 27-inch portable TV for $300, but you don't want that 27-inch portable. You want that 6-foot big screen TV for $3,000, and you don't care. You're going to take out a loan to get it. You're not going to save up your money to get it like a better Christian would. You're just going to take out a loan and flippantly, well, the hell with it, I'll pay the interest. That's what always defeats us. That is probably our biggest plague in society today. Because if we didn't have this flippant consumer attitude where we all have a year's or 2 years of our salaries in debt on credit cards, and we're paying 10%, 15%, 20% of our annual pay, of our annual salary, instead of returning that money into the community, we're paying that money to the Jew in interest to those banks, and those banks are taking that money and they're investing it overseas.
Absolutely. Or they're buying up farms and real property in this country. They're buying tangible assets.
Well, the Jews have destroyed Christianity with usury because Christians don't understand how money works, and they don't understand how usury works. I mean, anybody could understand what paying 10% on a loan means, but they don't understand the greater effects that usury has on the community.
All right. Marr credits Jews with bringing economic benefits to Germany. There is no way to deny that the abstract, money-oriented, haggling minds of the Jews has contributed much to the flourishing of commerce and industry in Germany. And I would dispute that and say that they've really never contributed anything to industry. Commerce and industry are two different things. The Jew is great at interfering with the natural barter process or the natural exchange process by taxing the process, but he's not great at bringing about a company out of nothing. You'll never see a Carnegie or a Ford. None of those people are Jews, but the Jews are great at hijacking those companies, pushing through regulation and oversight, and then becoming middlemen and compliance experts. They're the reason we have such a convoluted internal tax code, and you have to pay experts to make sense of it. And the experts are always Jews.
It's neo-Phariseeism.
Although racial anti-Semites are often portrayed as viewing Jews as genetically inferior or even subhuman, a very strong tendency among racial anti-Semites is to see Jews as a very talented group. Marr clearly sees Jews as an elite. And indeed, they are an elite within our society. They're jumped up, artificially elevated. They're basically trash with cash. If suddenly the stock market were to go away, electricity powered down across the U.S., and it was basically he who does not work, as in work in the field, work in his garden, work in the lake, getting fish, does not eat, every single Jew would starve to death, except those that happen to be sitting on warehouses full of goods and could
Eli and I read James chapters 3-5 last night, and they fully indicate that these elite are going to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
The Bible understands that scum rises to the top of a pond. We might think that cream rises to the top, but the Jews are no glass of milk.
Absolutely. And doesn't it say that they will throw their silver and gold into the streets? All the good their money is going to do them in the coming days. Indeed, Marr sees the Germans as inferior to the Jews and as having a melange of traits that caused them to lose the battle to the Jews. Now, that's ridiculous, though, since the Germans are vastly superior to the Jews in terms of qualities that should be lauded. I don't consider craftiness and cunning to be traits that are lauded and respected, do you?
Well, no, but they just happen to be better survival skills, right?
In the environment.
Unless you can recognize the crafty and the cunning.
Absolutely. In the battle that was fought, the Jews were better equipped to win the battle. That's how it should be worded. Into this confused, clumsy Germanic element penetrated a smooth, crafty, pliable Jewry with all of its gifts of realism, as opposed to German idealism, intellectually well qualified as far as the gift of astuteness is concerned, to look down upon the Germans and subduing the monarchical, knightly, lumbering German by enabling him in his vices. And the Jews have always been great enablers and panderers, haven't they?
Well, the real problem with the Christian is not understanding the mind of the Jew, and we can't. What we are usually, as a people, throughout history, been very naive to the devices of those who want to destroy us. We can't imagine how they think because we don't think like that. White Christians, being basically good people without guile, can't imagine why the family moving into their community would want to rule over and destroy all of their neighbors.
You know, the white man doesn't wake up in the morning thinking, I shall destroy the Jews today. We'll have another 6 million. It'll be a Holocaust. And then he sings Defanahoke when he's in the shower. Where the Jew may very well wake up, Oy vey, what can I do today to take money from the Goyim, to make, get them to defile their women with the Negroes, and send their children to the communist indoctrination centers all year round? I mean, I wonder, do they actually get up consciously thinking that each day they're going to do something to hurt the Goyim?
Well, no, but Christians, a good Christian wakes up every morning wondering what he could do for his family. A Jew wakes up every morning thinking about what he can get for himself. That's the difference.
All right. What we Germans don't have is the drive of the Semitic people. On account of our tribal organization, we shall never be able to acquire such a drive, and because cultural development knows no pause, our outlook is none other than a time when we Germans will live as slaves under the legal and political feudalism of Judaism. Well, the whole world lives as a slave to Jewry.
Well, now it does, yes. There's no doubt.
German indolence, Germanic stinginess, convenient Teutonic disdainfulness of expression are responsible for the fact that the agile and clever Israel now decides what one shall say and what not. I just hate how this guy keeps calling them Semites and Israelites.
Well, he just doesn't understand their false identity, right?
They're liars, but that's just part of their
today
crime.
We had the Jews and the ADL and the Southern Poverty Law Center and all of these Jewish organizations. And with the NAACP, the NAACP is basically a Jewish organization too, right? And
yeah.
They decide what one should say and what one should not. Well, when I was a kid in the 70s, I remember that blacks wanted to be called Negroes. Now they see it as a slur. In the 80s, they wanted to be called black. And in the 90s, they wanted to be called African American. Don't call me black. I'm African American.
And in 1910, they were happy to just be called boy.
Well, right. And all at the same time while calling each other nigger. And that's just one example of the way that these groups feel that they should control what one should say and what one should not.
Here's one of the great faults of the generic white nationalists, though, the people that don't see the religious issue, and it's the main issue. They say the Jews are cunning, the Jews are crafty, the Jews are intelligent, the Jews lie, the Jews manipulate. But then they believe the Jews when the Jews claim to be the chosen people and the people of Moses, the people of the book.
That's an incredible blindness, isn't it?
They admit that the Jews are very cunning and deceitful, but then they believe the Jews when they claim they're God's people.
And the last thing you should believe is a Jew. When he's moving his lips, he's lying.
You have turned the press over to them because you find brilliant frivolity more to your liking than moral fortitude. The Jewish people thrive because of their talents, and you have been vanquished, as you should have been, and as you deserved a thousandfold. Page 30. Are we willing to sacrifice? Did we succeed in creating even a single anti-Jewish leaning paper which manages to be politically neutral, to de-Judaize ourselves, for that we clearly lack physical and spiritual strength?
Now, well, right, exactly. We don't. I made this point last week. Conservative Christians, good conservative Christians, generally don't go attacking their enemies. You don't see right-wing conservatives causing trouble in left-wing arenas, do you?
No, it's the other way around.
It's always the other way around. And that's, you know, in Nazi Germany, in Weimar Germany, the Jewish communist thugs would go around to every political meeting that was right of center and cause trouble and break it up. And that's why Hitler had brown shirts. And when the Jewish communist thugs showed up at National Socialist meetings, they ran into a problem. They found a right-wing conservative people that was not afraid to stand up to them and oppose them and beat them down into the street when they deserved it.
Typically, that's how you deal with a troublemaker. If a troublemaker keeps coming around and won't go away, won't take a hint, you say, hey, this is our meeting hall, get out. And the troublemaker doesn't understand it. You just have to beat them bloody. They understand that. Everyone does.
Well, that's, you know, people have freedom of speech to go speak in their own meeting hall. If you have something to say, go rent your own hall, go distribute your own placards, and you'll be able to say it. And if people show up, fine. But you can't walk into my meeting hall and start running your mouth. And that's what the liberals, the leftists, the progressives, the Bolsheviks, that's what they always do. And when they do it, they deserve to be beat into the ground.
Exactly.
But white right-wing Christians are usually sheepish and timid and guileless and can't even understand why these left-wingers do that.
And they think that they have to give these leftists equal time, meaning their time and their audience. But in actuality, free speech basically means if what the left-winger has to say has any merit, he'll go rent his hall and he'll draw an audience because they'll want to hear it. But what he has to say is usually worthless.
Exactly. And when you see people walking into somebody else's hall and yelling and screaming, 999 times out of 1,000, it's a Jew. Look at what happened last week during the election, and this Jewess went to an Ayn Rand rally, right, and caused a big commotion, and somebody, some good man, got up and beat her to hell up, just like she deserved.
I marvel in admiration at the Semitic people, which put its heel onto the nape of our necks. Well, this is right out of scripture. We harbor a resilient, tough, intelligent foreign tribe among us, who knows how to take advantage of every form of abstract reality. We are no longer a match for this foreign tribe.
Absolutely, because we didn't have brown shirts soon enough and in enough numbers. We should have had some brown shirts in this country during the 60s, when Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman and all those clowns were at it.
Well, we did, but they killed Commander Rockwell.
And nobody else would stand up.
As a result of his high estimation of Jews and low estimation of Germans, Marr claims that he does not hate Jews. It's simply a war where one side loses. The conflict between Jews and Germans is like a war. How can I hate the soldier whose bullet happens to hit me? Does not one offer one's hand as victor as well as a prisoner of war? In my eyes, it's a war which has been going on for 1,800 years. Despite their long history of living together, Jews, unlike other peoples who have come to Germany, remain foreigners among the Germans. The separatism that is fundamental to Judaism as a group evolutionary strategy, and hence my titles, A People That Shall Dwell Alone and Separation and Its Discontents. The Jew was a typical foreigner to them and remained one until today. And yes, his exclusive Judaism, as we shall demonstrate in what follows, shows itself even more today after his emancipation than it did in earlier times. Is he referring to the emancipation of the Napoleonic era?
He must be, because that's the only time that the Jew was emancipated completely in Europe, that when they were made equal citizens with Christians in Europe that I can name. But Kevin McDonald also, again, is betraying his total ignorance of biblical history by taking for granted that the Jews are who they say they are. And like you said, Christians, knowing that Jews are the world's greatest liars, should never believe them when they claim to be the people of the book.
It's just one more lie in a pile of lies.
Well, if the Jews were the people of the Bible would be a banking manual. And Jesus Christ, if Jesus Christ was a Jew, he'd have been doing stand-up and not parables.
He'd have been a potty mouth.
Absolutely.
He wouldn't have spoken in parables. He would have had one-liners, wouldn't he? And I would just like to comment on the emancipation of Jewry. They weren't made equals with Christians. They were made superior to Christians, weren't they? Since Christians could not loan unto usury, Christians could not do a number of things, and Jews were suddenly elevated, given all the rights Christians had in the way of property ownership, but they also had the right to engage in commerce that was off limits to Christians. So it was natural, it was inevitable, that once you fully emancipate the Jews and give them all the civil rights and property rights of Christians, along with the right to create money out of nothing and loan it at interest, the Jew is ultimately going to own your entire country, isn't he?
It's the inevitable result. If only one person in your village is allowed to create his own money and loan it out at interest, it's the absolute inevitable result. It's like a law of physics that one person ends up owning all of the property in the village.
Sure. I mean, tomorrow, if the governor in Ohio said that we're making our own currency called the Ohio dollar, and Brian here is the only person who can print this money, you have to go to him to get it. Well, I'm going to own Ohio. I basically already would, wouldn't I? I'd own the whole state.
It's inevitable. There's no. It's like a law of physics. There's no stopping it. So the Jews on Wall Street, because the Jewish banking families that really own and control the stock of the banks, the voting shares of the banks that hold the Federal Reserve, because they have an exclusive license to create money from nothing and loan it at interest, it's inevitable that they end up owning the entire country. There's no way around that.
And isn't that what Rothschild said? Give me the power to print the nation's currency, and I care not who writes the law.
Well, he knew. He understood the power of compound interest and the ability to have an exclusive franchise to loan money at interest to the entire body of people in the nation. He understood what that would lead to.
It gives the Jew a monopoly on commerce. You can't deal in business without using his currency.
It gives the Jew the total control of the commerce and politics of the nation.
Unless we all operate on a barter system.
Which is why 100 years after the Federal Reserve, they totally own our political system. We have the pretense of going to vote, but we're voting for candidates that were chosen, and no matter what candidate is chosen, the agenda of Wall Street progresses.
Well, they finance all the candidates, or the ones that they're okay with winning. And if they're not okay with somebody winning, they won't even be on the ballot.
Absolutely.
Not in a major party, anyway.
And anybody that bucks the system gets shot, right? Jack Kennedy.
All other immigration into Germany disappeared without a trace within Germanism. Wends and Slavs disappeared in the German element. The Semitic race, stronger and tougher, has survived them all. Truly, were I a Jew, I would look upon this fact with my greatest pride. One of Marr's most interesting observations in his proposal that Germans formed idealistic images of Jews during the Enlightenment when others had more realistic and negative views. Jews are realists, accepting the world as it is and advancing their interests based on their understanding of this reality. Judaism is characterized by particularist morality. Is it good for the Jews? Germans, on the other hand, tend to have idealized images of themselves and others, to believe that the human mind can construct reality based on ideals that can then shape behavior.
And that's basically what I said before about Germans, about Christians not being able to realize that the strangers among us think differently than us. We think that they think like we do.
They are predisposed to moral universalism. Moral rules apply to everyone and are not dependent on whether it benefits the in-group. And this is one thing I really resent the pagans and the other atheist-type white nationalists. They always say that we should have a single commandment. Is it good for whites? Well, that would just make us white Jews, basically, then. We'd be whites practicing Judaism.
Well, that's exactly what it would make us, whites practicing Judaism. And let me say that the Jews have always thrived in pagan societies. When Rome was pagan, when Greek was pagan, when Spain was pagan, the Jews had a field day in those nations. The Jews hated the coming of Christianity. They hated it when Christianity became the official religion of the empire, and they hated it when Christian moral principles were enforced, and the Jew was excoriated from society by those Christian moral principles. They hated that. They hated it so much that they went and got the Arabs to invade Spain. They went and got the Turks to beat down the Byzantine Empire, one city at a time.
And then
that's how much the Jews hated it.
Communism, atheism, Freemasonry, Illuminatism.
Absolutely. They were all Jewish constructs aimed at destroying Christian civilization. And neo-paganism, the Enlightenment, the religion of evolution, the religion of humanism, are all Jewish constructs to destroy Christianity. The pagans are playing right into the hands of the Jew. It's only Christianity and a proactive Christianity that can withstand the darts of the devil, that can withstand and illuminate the Jew for what he is.
And that's why we're targeted, because we're a threat to organized Jewry. The Odinists aren't a threat to anybody.
No. The only thing the Odinists are a threat to are the local liquor store.
I was about to say that. I was going to say that. Wow, you're one step ahead of me, Bill. This is a reference to the powerful idealist strand of German philosophy that has been so influential in the culture of the West. An illustrative example is American Transcendentalism, a movement that created an indigenous culture of critique in 19th century America. This perspective resulted in overly optimistic views of human nature intended toward radical egalitarianism. It also provided the theoretical underpinnings the abolitionist movement among elite intellectuals like Ralph Waldo Emerson. And of course, we can't take universalism that far in terms of other races, but in terms of morality, if it's wrong to rob a white person, it's also wrong to rob a Negro, where the Jew wouldn't grant that. The Jew would say it's wrong to rob a Jew, but it's not wrong to rob a Goyim. Indeed, it's preferred to rob a Goyim.
Well, whether we like it or not, the Old Testament tells us that we'll have one law for ourselves and for the stranger in our land.
Yes.
That's just the way it is. Even the Declaration of Independence, where it says that all men are created equal, it really means that all men are created equal within the eyes of the law.
Yes.
However, that doesn't mean that we should be forced to trade with people of other races. We should be able to choose who we trade with, and we should always favor our own race at the exclusion of the other races.
You have the right to pick your associates, and you have the right to disassociate yourself. If you don't want some Negro coming in your house and going after your daughter, you have the right to say, no, you can't come in here. And I think the residents of the neighborhood have the right to sign a restrictive covenant and say, these people don't have the right to move in here.
And that would be a lynching, right?
They would call that a lynching today, wouldn't they?
Well, it would be a justifiable one, is what I'm trying to say.
Oh, okay.
That's the covenant. No, right. You should have a right to determine who your children marry and who they don't. That's an organic right that our race has always asserted, that's taken away from us under the rule of the Jew in this nation the last 50 years.
You have a vested interest in who fathers your grandchildren.
Absolutely.
In particular, Marr notes that whereas prominent and influential Enlightenment thinkers like Voltaire were critics of Judaism, seeing it as a reactionary tribalism, in Germany, the most influential writer was Gotthold Ephraim Lessing. I wonder who he was. 1729 to 1781. Lessing presented a very positive image of Judaism in his play Nathan the Wise. The Jewish Nathan, Marr called him Rothschild to give it contemporary relevance, makes an eloquent plea for religious tolerance, while at the same time he finances the Muslim war against Christian crusaders. Marr suggests that Lessing engaged in a bit of self-deception. Despite his positive portrayal of Nathan as the essence of tolerance, Lessing could not, in his subconscious self, overcome the identity of Jews and servant of Mammon, page 15. So no matter
how hard isn't that the truth about them? Isn't what he tell the truth about them? He showed him as a two-faced bastard and pleading for religious tolerance while bringing the Muslims into war against Christianity, and then he showed him as his plain self, a servant of Mammon.
So who would make a plea for tolerance while financing a war of religion? A Jew.
That's what the Jews have been doing in this country for 100 years.
We have to tolerate the Muslims here, but we have to go blow them to pieces in the nations that neighbor Israel to make Israel safe.
Well, we have to tolerate Judaism and Islam and outlaw Christianity.
So the kids will face Mecca. In Britain, they wanted the kids to experience what it was like to be a Muslim, so they made them face Mecca 5 times during the school day and say prayers out of the Quran. And they each had to take
if they really wanted the kids to find out what it was like to be a Muslim, they should make them go lay in the sand in Palestine under an Israeli tank.
If they want the women to find out what it's like to be Islamic, well, I won't even go into that. I can't even go there. It's just not appropriate. We don't even want to imagine it. The influence of Lessing was profound. German idealism was captivated by the legend of the ring, i.e. Lessing's metaphor for religious tolerance, but missed that Lessing's Nathan could only be a character from a fable. So if you ever hear a story about a Jew doing something good, it has to be a fable. That's what it boils down to. Marr suggests that instead of a fictional character like Nathan the Wise, Lessing could have seen 17th century Jewish philosopher Baruch Spinoza as an illustration of what Judaism is really like. Or he could have just read the Bible and figured out what Judaism is really like.
Absolutely.
Whereas Nathan the Wise suggests that religious tolerance is a characteristic of Judaism, Marr interprets Spinoza's fate as illustrating Jewish intolerance and fanaticism in the real world. Features of Judaism also noted by several contemporary writers, most notably Israel Shahak, but also including Enlightenment thinkers like Voltaire. Was Voltaire a Jew?
Well, you know, he really did fit the description. He fit the mold. He was a humanist. But I don't know if he was a Jew. Voltaire is not his real name. I don't remember his real name, but it's not Voltaire.
All right. Spinoza was hounded out of the Jewish community of Amsterdam because of his views on religion. This truly great Jewish non-Jew, had been cursed by his own tribal associates all the way to attempted murderous assault, page 16. So today, they would call him a self-hating Jew, wouldn't they, as if there is such a creature? Oh, wasn't Voltaire François-Marie Arouet?
Yes.
And he was born into a family of notaries and treasury officials, lawyers, and it says something about ambassadors. His family were all involved in the French treasury. That's not a mark in his favor, is it?
Well, no, not at all. And I've always wondered about Voltaire's real background, but I don't know if we'd be able to scratch the surface on him to find out what his real racial origins were.
He studied law. His father found him studying poetry one day, so they sent him away and forced him to study law.
Well, he was educated by the Jesuits. Hmm. So if he wasn't a Jew by race, he was surely a Jew between the ears.
Hmm. But in the 19th century, woe to the German who dares to show the Jewish masses who the great Spinoza was and what he stood for. Another trait of Germans that Marr sees as deleterious is abstract individualism. Marr states that Jewish economic success within capitalism is in agreement with the dogma of abstract individualism, which you have accepted with enthusiasm from the hands of Judaism.
Well, the Jews are the manufacturers of the egotistical, narcissistic society, and we have accepted it again in full force in this era.
The me generation.
Absolutely. The Jews created the star. They created the
American Idol.
Exactly. It's an idolatrous society, and they started this creation back in the late 19th century in this country, but it had already gone on in 16th and 17th centuries Germany.
In other words, Marr believes that individualism was something Jews imposed on Germany, not a tendency within the Germans themselves. Contrary to Marr's position, I have argued that the fundamental uniqueness of European peoples is a greater tendency towards individualism than other groups. Individualism then leads to moral universalism, a form of idealism, rather than the tribally based morality of groups like the Jews. As noted above, Marr correctly believed that individualistic societies are relatively defenseless against Jews, whereas societies centered around a strong collectivist religious core, such as medieval Christianity, or a strong sense of ethnic nationalism are more able to defend themselves.
Well, a collectivist religious core is what biblical Christianity should be. Read Acts chapter 4. Mm-hmm. That is what Christianity should be like. Okay? Now, Acts chapter 4 through 7, through the stoning of the martyr Stephen. If you look at Adolf Hitler's economic policies, you will again see that same collectivist national religious core.
But you won't see 1919 Soviet collectivism raise your right hand in the air and sing the International.
No. There's a complete difference between Christian collectivism and Sovietism. There is a huge difference between them. And Sovietism really isn't collectivism in any true sense at all.
No.
Sovietism is really collecting the wealth of the nation into the hands and control of the Jew.
Yes.
That's what Bolshevik collectivism is, right? Christian collectivism is a sharing of the wealth of the community with those who work for the community who also uphold certain moral values. And if they don't uphold those values, you put them out of the community.
All right.
It's that simple. And Christian collectivism also respects property rights, and you have the full control over the destiny of your property.
All right.
All giving is based on the voluntary the needs and the volunteerism of the giver.
Because of their grievances against Europeans, it is not surprising that Jews support revolution. Who can hold it against the Jews that they happily welcomed the revolutions of 1789 and the one of 1848 and actively participated in them? They didn't welcome them. They instigated them and planned them.
This Absolutely.
This guy has weights over his eyes, doesn't he?
Well, right. But, you know, he foresees the destruction of Germany at the hands of the Jews, but he doesn't understand all of the forces behind it. No, that's clear.
Jews,
and we'll see that when we read his full paper.
Jews, Poles, and writers was the battle cry of the conservatives in 1848. Well, of course, three suppressed factions. I don't think writers were ever suppressed at that time, were they? They were allowed to freely distribute their writings.
I know in the 19th century that there were very few restrictions on writings anywhere in Christian Europe.
Mm.
Even the czars let the Jewish left-wing Bolshevik newspapers operate freely.
Well, we discussed the czar had, 5,000 police in the largest country in the world. And I guarantee you, when the Jews came to power, they had 5,000 police in one neighborhood of Moscow.
Well, we have twice that many in the subways of New York.
There are, I believe, 600,000 police in this country today. The Tsar had 5,000 police for a country of 80-plus million. We have over 600,000 for a country of maybe 350 million.
And 5% of them are in New York, where you have the most Jews and the most Negroes.
The Jews need to be protected the most, don't they? Well, if I were out there stealing up an entire nation, I'd want a lot of police protecting me too, wouldn't you?
Absolutely.
Following his first decisive victory of 1848, he had to, whether he wanted to or not, pursue his success further and must now attempt to ruin the Germanic Occidental world. Page 28. Would you like to take over for a while?
By 1848, Judaism had entirely ceased being a religion at all. It was nothing else but the constitution of a people forming a state within a state, and the secondary or counter state demanded certain material advantages for its members. There, I would like to say that Marr and possibly MacDonald are totally oblivious to what the true religion of the Jew is. The true religion of the Talmud is a purely economic religion. It only seeks material advantages for the Jew. To continue, Marr states that Jewish emancipation only meant political equality because Jews had already achieved a leading and dominating role and dominated all political factions except the Catholics. The daily press is predominantly in Jewish hands, and this is in 1848, which have transformed journalism into a business with public opinion. And we see that that's all journalism is in this country, right?
Shaping the minds of the nation, basically.
Well, right. They lie through the news, through the media, in order to shape the minds of the nation. All they print is lies in order to shape public opinion.
And what they choose to print, what they choose not to print, there are things going on in this nation that we have no idea about. I've talked to people about the Wichita Massacre, and they say the Wichita what? They think it must have been some hate crime against black people.
Right. The daily press is predominantly in Jewish hands, which have transformed journalism into a business with public opinion. Critique of the theater, of art in general, is to three-quarters in the hands of the Jews. Writing about politics and even religion is in Jewish hands, while Jews are deeply involved in creating the culture of Germany, or I should say, the anti-culture that arose in Germany. Quote, Judaism has been declared a subject off limits for us Germans, just like Americans can't talk about Judaism in this century.
You can't say the word Jew unless you're going to say Jesus was a Jew, Jews are God's chosen people.
Well, right, exactly.
You can't bring the word up.
To comment on Jewish rituals is, quote-unquote, hatred. But if the Jew takes it upon himself to pronounce the last word in our religious and state affairs, then it is quite a different matter. So that hypocrisy is age-old, and Christians still don't see it.
Every time they have a TV conference discussing morality, they always have some rabbi on there saying, "Rabbi, what do the Jewish people teach about so-and-so, and it's some great moral issue. If they're 1% of the world, why do we need to hear what they teach about whatever? Who cares? Why do they always
Why would we ask a rabbi about morality when they feel it's absolutely legitimate to fillet little boys?
Or you ask them, what does Judaism teach about the afterlife? Why are we asking a rabbi anything about the afterlife? Usually they dance around it. Sometimes they'll come right out and say Judaism teaches there is no afterlife. That's pretty telling, isn't it?
Jews are particularly involved in the culture struggle against ultramontanism, the view that papal authority should extend over secular affairs. Ultramontanism was attacked by Jews because the church opposed Judaism for world domination. Although opposition to ultramontanism was also an interest for many Germans, Jews did all the talking, and any criticism of Roman Catholicism was banned, quote, if Israel was touched on ever so slightly, unquote, meaning the Jews. Jews are powerful, and they will continue to obtain more power. In the end, Germans will be at the mercy of the Jews. Within less than four generations, there will not be a single office in the land, including the highest office, which will not have been usurped by the Jews. Yes, through Jewry, Germany will become a world power, an Occidental Palestine. Jewry has fought the Occident for 1,800 years. It has conquered and subjected it. We are the vanquished, and it is quite in order that the victor chants, "Vi victis," woe to the vanquished.
And that happened in about two generations. It didn't take four.
Well, no, it didn't take four, but I don't think Mars foresaw a lot, but he didn't foresee the First World War and the Weimar Republic, right? The Jew has no real religion. He has a business contract with Jehovah and pays his God with statutes and formulations, and in return is charged with the pleasant task of exterminating all that is not Jewish. Well, the sad part about that is that Mars didn't realize that Jehovah or Yahweh was not the God of the Jew. However, luckily, Hitler did. Mars saw Russia as the only European nation that had resisted the Jewish onslaught. However, he believed that Russia would eventually fall by bloody revolution, and this revolution would lead to the downfall of the West.
And that happened.
Absolutely. Mars says, among European nations, only Russia is left to still resist the foreign invasion. The final surrender of Russia is only a question of time. Jewish resilient fly-by-night attitude will plunge Russia into a revolution like the world might never have seen before. With Russia, Jewry will have captured the last strategic position from which it has to fear a possible attack on its rear. After it has invaded Russia's offices and agencies the same way it did ours, then the collapse of our Western society will begin in earnest, openly, and in Jewish fashion. The last hour of doomed Europa will strike at the latest in 100 to 150 years.
He was sure off the time, though.
Well, he was exactly on the money there. But European society, it was probably closer to 100 years and more like 90 or 80 or 70, right? I mean, it depends. Where do you want to start the clock on that? World War II, World War I, World War II? What? The wars here, the culture war here in the 60s and 70s? I mean, it's the Jews have won war after war in the West, right?
They've won everything.
Yes, they have, because Christians worship the Jews instead of worshiping their God.
Has there ever been a war or a cultural war that the Jews haven't won?
Not since Satan was led out of the pit 300 years ago, and the Jews have won every war since, right? That's the fulfillment of Revelation 20. We're in the time of Gog and Magog now. We are already surrounded by our enemies. Indeed, Jews are already taking the lead in fomenting anti-Russian policy, as in the Russian-Turkish War, which you want to speak about, right? For example, ideas that the insolence of the great sea power England might be curbed by allying with Russia were banned from the Jewish newspapers. Marr is entirely pessimistic about the future, foreseeing a cataclysm. The destructive mission of Judaism, which also existed in antiquity, will only come to a halt once it has reached its culmination, that is, after Jewish Caesarism has been installed. Well, that would be probably what Marr is calling the New World Order, right? Jewry will have to face a final desperate assault, particularly by Germanism, before it will achieve authoritarian dominance. That's exactly what happened. That's exactly what happened with Adolf Hitler and World War II. Marr thinks that anti-Jewish attitudes will become powerful, but ultimately they will fail to fend off disaster for the Germans in the West. 1930s. Marr lays part of the blame on the fact that the only people who publicly oppose the Jews conceptualize them incorrectly as a religion. Well, Hitler did oppose them as a race. As a result, responsible, informed criticism of Jews that would appeal to non-religious people and intellectual elites never appears in the press. A catastrophe lies ahead because the indignation against the Judaization of society is intensified by the fact that it can't be ventilated in the press without showing itself as a most abstruse religious hatred, such as it surfaces in the ultramontane and generally in the reactionary press. Nevertheless, even a violent anti-Jewish explosion will only delay but not avert the disintegration of Judaized society. And that's exactly true. Judaized society has to disintegrate.
Regarding
his own mission, Marr sees himself as a soldier fighting a lost cause. He says, "I am aware that my journalist friends and I stand defenseless before Jewry. We have no patronage among the nobility or the middle class. Our German people are too Judaized to have the will for self-preservation." Sounds just like America today. Marr concludes with the following. The battle had to be fought without hatred against the individual combatant who was forced into the role of attacker or defender. Tougher and more persistent than we, you, meaning the Jew, became victorious in this battle between people, which you fought without the sword, while we massacred and burned you, but did not muster the moral strength to tell you to live and deal among your own. Well, Hitler tried that, but he was stopped by the Jewish pansies, America and Great Britain.
The Jews don't want to live among their own.
No, they can't live among their own. A pile of ticks can't live amongst itself. Parasites need corpses.
Sure, they need cats and dogs. All right,
no doubt.
We're going to pick up in a few weeks here and actually read the entire article.
Right, I'll be off next week. I'm going to out of state to see my son, and I won't be here at all.
Okay, great. So the weekend after, most likely, we will pick up and we will read The Victory of Judaism Over Germanism.
Absolutely.
Praise Yahweh.
We will prevail. Wilhelm Marr did not see that, but we will prevail.
That's because he didn't know Scripture.
Right.
Otherwise, his story would have a different ending. Praise Yahweh.
Absolutely.